We are very excited that you are all on this quarterly call today. We've got some great updates for you, as well as some amazing guest speakers today to talk about a kind of, you know, hot new topic that's on everybody's mind. So we're very excited to be able to engage in that conversation and present some thoughts and ideas to you on this call today. So again, thank you for taking time out of your busy day to join us. One update that I wanted to specifically talk about before Aaron jumps in with a number of other items that we know are important to you, and that is, of course, funding the appropriations for all of the DD councils. Those of you who are constantly on appropriations watch know time is ticking fast. It is December 10th. We have until December 20th for Congress to make a decision as to whether or not they are going to pass a spending bill that would be a final bill that would get DD councils, as well as our sister programs, the PNAs and the USEDs, and so many other programs, of course, the remainder of their funding for the rest of the fiscal year. So we are eagerly awaiting to see what is going to happen over the course of these next 10 days. So it's really crunch time. We expect that if there's going to be serious action, it will happen this week. There's a deal that we know would have to be struck and announced imminently in time to draft, read out, assemble, and score the package, post it online, and take a vote. So it's a heavy lift. I got to be honest, it's a heavy lift to do in the next week or so. So we're keeping our eyes and ears open and really watching this. You know, in terms of the actual funding package and what would be in this bill for DD councils and other programs, we know and care deeply about. That piece is really not what's contentious. But there's a host of other unresolved issues that are plaguing these negotiations. One of them, of course, is funding for the border wall. I'm sure most of you are familiar with that ongoing debate that seems to keep plaguing us. And we know that there's been some talks going on toward an agreement that, frankly, neither party is going to be happy with, but it would allow each party, that being Congress and the other party being the president, it would allow each side to have, you know, something that they would win on. President Trump would retain his authority to transfer funds from the Pentagon to border security accounts, but Congress would be happy in keeping the new wall funding flat from FY 2019 levels instead of adding more money into funding the wall. In addition to that issue, there's a whole list of other things that are plaguing the forward movement of this bill, including the surprise billing legislation, H.R. 3, that was introduced just a few days ago, tax extenders and healthcare extenders, reauthorization of the Export-Import Bank, federally backed flood insurance, terrorism risk insurance program, and so many other things which do not directly impact our work as DD councils, but they will potentially impact movement on this bill. So, you know, I wish I had a crystal ball and could tell you what's going to happen in the next week or two. I don't have that crystal ball. I want to remain hopeful that a negotiation will be struck and a deal will be struck, and we will be able to finalize everything before December 20th. We know how important that getting this funding bill done is for DD councils. We know that for many of you, without your final and full year allotment, there's a lot of work that you cannot move forward on. But, you know, we're doing the best that we can to pressure Congress to move forward on a bill. But, you know, as I said, these issues, these poison pills like the wall funding are bigger than us. And so we can only hope for the best. So what happens if they can't strike a deal? If they cannot strike a deal, they will have to do another continuing resolution. I'm sure that that language is already written and ready to go in somebody's back pocket. Mitch McConnell's probably, and that would probably bump the process into mid-January or even early February. So we hope that won't happen. I do not foresee a government shutdown. Nobody wants that. Certainly nobody wants that at holiday season. So I'm certainly not forecasting that right now. But I will be honest and say I'm not going to be at all surprised if the can gets kicked down the road again into the new year. But we will keep you apprised. DD Council Executive Directors will get updates from me and or Aaron, and we'll keep you posted as this moves forward. So that is my update on our spending bills. I'm going to kick this over to Aaron, who I know has some updates on other issues of the day.
Thanks so much, Donna. Hi, everyone. How are you all doing, Policy Watchers? I was thinking about how we would spend the next couple of minutes of the update. Usually I give you a couple of ideas of bills that are in the hopper. Since we're at the end of the year and everyone's scrambling towards finishing appropriations and some of these extender bills and, of course, impeachment, I thought instead I would look at some of the highlights from 2019, go over the good and the bad. 2019 was a very turbulent year here at NACDD. We spent most of our time, frankly, on the defense because the administration kept looking to use the regulatory process in some cases to roll back certain rights that we hold dear with our mission for community living. But there were a few wins that I want us all to remember as we gear up for this next important legislative year. Don't let anyone tell you that we haven't done anything this year. We sure have, and I want us to feel good about that. There's a lot we can accomplish working together while fighting those who'd roll back these hard-earned rights to community living. So let's talk about this the next few minutes, about some of the highlights and lowlights of our work here at NACDD during the past year. Here's the good. As Donna mentioned, we spend a lot of our time working on appropriations. We do this because of our mission to make sure the DD councils are able to continue the amazing work you do supporting community living and filling those gaps in the states where we need to provide more access to needed services for people so that they can live their best lives in the community. I am very proud of the work done in our DD Council appropriations in the House. Although the Administration for Community Living recommended significant cuts to the DD Act programs, NACDD was successful in lobbying for increased funding levels in the House bill. The House passed version contains $80 million for state councils on developmental disabilities. Now, this is a $4 million increase over the fiscal 2019 enacted level, and it's $24 million above the ACL fiscal year 2020 budget request. You know, as Donna mentioned, just because we have a great House bill doesn't mean we're going to have a final bill. And, of course, we don't expect to have those same numbers in that full amount when we do have some sort of final decision by the Senate. The Senate has not even had hearings on the labor HHS bill. So we're just working off of rumors and conjectures. But I assure you that Donna and I are working, and our consultants are working around the clock with the Likely Hill conferees and the high-level leadership so that whatever comes out, whether it's a continuing resolution and eventually a possible final appropriations bill, we're going to do the best we can to put the DD councils in the best position to do the work that you need to do to do the systems change we need to make the community living a reality in our states and territories. By the way, this is the third year in a row that we've fought off significant cuts from the administration. This is very good news that our Hill champions stand by us because we expect, you know, similar pushback, you know, next year, and we're already beginning to prepare for 2021. Moving on. Wow, the Autism Cares Reauthorization Act was signed into law. Can you imagine a world without the LEND program? We can't, and that's one of the reasons why we work so hard on the Autism Cares Act. This bill expanded research and coordination, it increased public awareness and surveillance, expanded interdisciplinary health and professional training, including our LEND, and it helped to identify and support children and youth with autism and their families. The way I see Autism Cares is it's the blueprint for the way that the federal government is going to spend money to make sure that that children and youth with autism and their families, as well as adults with autism, get the best research, R&D, and supports and services. Sadly, this law was set to expire on September 30th of last year, and with all the political stuff going back and forth on the Hill, it was one of those things where we knew that once we got the bill to the floor, it would pass. It was just a matter of having the House and Senate prioritize autism and this important reauthorization over some of the other bills, which were, just as worthy of consideration. We worked extremely hard with our champions, Congressman Chris Smith and Michael Doyle, and Senators Michael Enzi and Bob Menendez on this bipartisan bill. And the entire DD network came back together. And, of course, we were thrilled when it was signed into law by President Trump, giving us that five-year extension of all these extremely important programs. Doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be authorized at the same levels. We'll have to fight every year to make sure the authorization is there. But without this reauthorization, these programs would have disappeared. So that was a tremendous win for our community, and we should all feel very good about that. In fact, many of you on the phone probably participated in the grassroots effort to make sure that the members of Congress knew that this was a priority for people with disabilities. Oh, another critical program that was set to expire this past year was the Money Follows the Person program, also known as the MFP program. Many of you are aware that this provides enhanced funding to states to help transition individuals who want to move out of institutional care and back into their community. At the very last minute, just when this was about to expire, on August 6th, President Trump signed into law the Sustaining Excellence in Medicaid Act. This law provides an extension of the MFP programs and something called the HCBS Spousal Impoverishment Programs, but only until the end of 2019. So we're relieved that the funding for these provisions were extended until the end of the year, and that's only for states currently participating in the MFP program. But we need to continue to push for long-term funding through 2020 and beyond. And importantly, we need to open up those programs to more states. So for the past few weeks, we've been coalition partners have been meeting with folks on the Hill to try to see if we can get that folded into some of these extenders that are going to pass in the next couple of weeks. But Money Follows the Person was not a given. That fight to get that extension was very difficult, and it really did take a sincere bipartisan effort and the president to make that happen. The other really nice victory, it's a small victory, but it's one of those victories that if you all work with families of people with disabilities, is very, very important. The Lifespan Respite Care Authorization Act of 2019 passed the House. It's important to know it's not law yet. It's only passed the House. But getting the House passage was, again, a matter of prioritizing this bill over just multitudes of other bills that have been fighting for floor time. We knew, again, if we got it to the floor, it would pass with unanimous consent and, in fact, or huge bipartisan support. And, in fact, it did. The Lifespan Respite Care Program authorizes grants to states to implement a statewide coordinated system of respite services, planned emergency respite services, recruitment and training for respite workers and volunteers, and information to family caregivers to help them access this respite care. Again, it's a small program, but 37 states in the District of Columbia use these ACL grants to improve access, quality, and affordability of respite for family caregivers of children and adults. The House bill passed rather quickly earlier this year, and it would extend the respite programs through 2024. But we're on pins and needles because we know the lead in our coalition has been working with Senate negotiators. So we do hope to have a final bill before the end of this year. We do not want to see these grant programs fade away. NACDD is grateful to our champions, Senators Sue Collins and Tammy Baldwin, and Representatives Jim Langevin and Kathy McMorris Rogers for their continued leadership on this. Okay, I have one more good, and then I got to scoot over to the bad because that list is long. And I know you'd rather hear about the environment, but let's talk about ABLE for just a second. Not a legislative win, but I want to focus you all on the fact that the ABLE Act celebrated its fifth anniversary this year. Can you believe it's been 5 years since you all worked so very hard to pass the Achieving a Better Life Experience Act? The update is that today, the good news is that we have over 50,000 individuals that have benefited from creating these tax-free savings accounts for people with disabilities who have a disability before the onset age of 26. That's great news. We've improved the lives of 50,000 individuals. Unfortunately, we know that millions of people with disabilities still aren't eligible for ABLE accounts because they didn't acquire that disability before 26. So we're going to continue to help add co-sponsors, and in fact, we have added dozens of co-sponsors to the ABLE Age Adjustment Act that would fix that and would make sure that more people are eligible to take advantage of these tax benefit savings plans. Take a deep breath, and I'm going to take a glass of water as I launch into the bad. We played a lot of defense this year. Sometimes it's hard to see, you know, gee, NACD, what are you doing? You know, what's going on with ABLE Age Adjustment? And why aren't we doing more with the Disability Integration Act? And don't get me started. This year we fought a lot of proposals, most from federal agencies, that would really hurt the whole concept of community and community living. It's a long list, and it's not even a comprehensive list, but here we go. In education, we saw some real threats to access to education. One was through the regulation that would have changed that would change Title IX. Title IX, of course, is the regulation that ensures that any federal programs, educational programs that accept federal funding, must protect students and prohibit schools from discriminating on the basis of sex. And you may ask me, Erin, why are we working on this? Well, believe it or not, people with disabilities also have a sex assigned to them. We often forget that the intersectional part of our work is really important, especially because, as studies show, often people with multiple forms of discrimination face these types of challenges. They're just more obstacles, and there are harsher consequences. And that, indeed, is the fact when it comes to Title IX and schools' obligations to provide environments that are free from sexual harassment and sexual assault. The National Council on Disability released a report earlier this year that showed that, overwhelmingly, colleges are not prepared to handle students with disability when they come and have claims of sexual assault or when they are defendants in sexual assault cases. So NACDD took the lead in organizing the disability community to oppose these proposed regulations that would let schools and colleges off the hook when it comes to providing a safe environment for all students. The proposed regulation weakened current regulations. For example, it would require that students face cross-examination in any Title IX proceedings. Obviously, for anyone who's worked with students with disabilities, this is extremely damaging and puts students, especially those who have communication issues or maybe use assisted devices to help with communication. Or what about students with anxiety disorders or students with IDD? Cross-examination is not an effective fact-finding method for certain students with disabilities. And, in fact, we have lots of data, mostly from the criminal law, criminal justice realm, that shows that cross-examination simply does not work for certain students, certain individuals with disability, and it's indeed very harmful. So there are lots of other examples, but NACD took the lead in organizing that, writing the comments, and we continue to work on that to make sure our students have safe environments. The final regs are expected at the beginning of next year, and honestly, we expect that they're going to be bad. So we're going to continue to have to watch that in our elementary, secondary, and higher education schools and see how schools will whether schools will continue to provide the accommodations our students need in Title IX proceedings or not, but we'll continue working on that. The other really scary proposal that we've spent an inordinate amount of time on has been proposals to weaken the Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act. So in early 2019, the Department of Education gave notice that they were going to change the WIOA regs, and most advocates saw this as an attack on regulations that currently require competitive and integrated employment for all people, especially people with disabilities. NACDD was an original member of a new coalition, the Coalition to Advance Competitive Integrated Employment, which also has mobilized to take action if this regulation ever comes out. We've had many meetings, but we've also sent many letters, including a letter recently with over 200 organizations to the new Acting Assistant Secretary for the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services, opposing the reopening of WIOA regulations. I want to also thank our grassroots and those of you on the phone who have given me the heads up when other coalitions who, in fact, do want to undo the WIOA regulations have tried to mobilize around this. It's really great when we can work cooperatively when we see those threats on the horizon. So thank you for that. You know, we continue to see some really bad stuff coming out of CMS, and I want to put a quick point on the Medicaid work requirement waivers. Earlier this year and even last year, CMS was actively encouraging states to, you know, think about rethink work requirements, and unfortunately, many states did. This waiver is opposed by NACDD, and it's really heartening to see several state DD councils working to oppose the Medicaid work requirement. Shout out to Tennessee, which I know has been doing a ton of work on that, as have other states. Another more bad news. Sorry, I told you the list was long, but I only have three more bad news, and then we'll get on to the fun stuff. More bad news on the transportation front. One of our public policy committee members from Wisconsin wanted to make sure that we were looking closely at the threat to non-emergency medical transportation. This is a service provided to beneficiaries that provides transportation for non-emergency cases. This could be things like dialysis, regular medical appointments, appointments for chronic conditions. Beneficiaries to this services in the states have received over 100 million rides each year. Without this type of transportation, many Medicaid beneficiaries could just simply not access the services, and it's too costly, and they need to stay at home and out of the hospital, possibly compromising their medical conditions. We heard earlier this year that CMS intended to roll back the benefit by rescinding the current regulation. The planned rule could make this benefit, which has been mandatory since 1966, it would make it optional at the state limit. And because of states' budgets and because of politics, we know that making this service optional would lead to people going without. NACD has endorsed legislation that would stop this, and we keep working in coalition so that, you know, when this proposed regulation comes out, we can oppose it. But it's not good news. This is definitely happening. The last two things are on immigration, and perhaps these are the saddest of all. We were shocked this September when news broke that that there was deportation of certain immigrants with serious medical conditions. Perhaps you all saw this. There's a visa program that allows people to obtain to have temporary status in our country if they're receiving treatment for serious medical conditions. And there was a decision by the administration to change the way they were looking at these cases and to end the program completely. The problem was, there are a lot of problems to that, but the legal problem is that the administration's decision to end this program came without any public comment or notice that would have allowed NACDD and other advocates for children with disabilities and their family to remain in the country to receive this often life-saving treatment. So NACDD immediately mobilized with some coalition partners and quickly to send some letters and to try to organize some meetings. But quickly the administration decided to reconsider that, ending that program. And they said that they have resumed the program, but that they would consider this on a case-by-case basis. We're following that matter really closely since we're not really sure you know what that means, but it is a sad day when our country is deporting people because they have disabilities. The final sad news is again immigration. NACD continues to fight discriminatory public charge rules. You've probably heard me talk about public charge rules. I know I've talked about it on quarterly calls. The last quarterly call, we had Allison Barkoff talk about NACD's role in joining an amicus brief that she's writing to oppose the public charge rule. In a nutshell, in October, the Department of Homeland Security rule was supposed to go into effect. This rule would keep people out who've used or maybe even one day might use certain government benefits. And although certain rules have been around for a while that kind of look like that, this rule expanded the number of benefits so that it would disproportionately hurt immigrants with disabilities. It was flat-out discriminatory. For example, under the previous policy, only a substantial reliance on cash benefits or Medicaid-funded long-term institutional care counted against someone who was considering when they were being considered for a visa or a green card. So only someone who was pretty certain that this person would require long-term institutional care. But the new rule is so broad, and the benefits have been so lowered that people can be considered a public charge even if they're receiving supplemental security income or non-emergency medical services, including home and community-based services. Those would all be heavily weighed against them. So as we learned last month, NACDD, the Center for Public Representation, and 17 other disability advocacy organizations represented by Latham Watkins filed amicus briefs opposing this motion, opposing this rule. And we were successful in getting a preliminary injunction, which means that the public charge rule cannot go into effect yet. But, you know, we don't know what's going to happen because the courts will have to rule on that injunction again as these cases move through the courts. So that's the good and the bad. I want to thank you all so much for your advocacy this year and all these matters and all the matters that we didn't have time to discuss. And I look forward to working with you as we start the second session of the 116th Congress in this January. We have just like 2 or 3 minutes. I'm sorry I went a little long. If there are any questions about things that are happening in Washington, you can ask me about impeachment. I probably won't know. Anyone have any questions? Well, I'm so glad I answered everybody's questions this time. So, again, looking forward to you working with you all in January. So thank you for sticking around through the legislative update. We're now ready to start our deep dive on disability and the environment, how plastic bans became a disability rights issue, and the need for a disability-inclusive approach in the environmental movement. Last week, the United Nations Climate Change Conference was held, and here in the United States, you've probably heard many presidential candidates scramble to be seen as the environmental candidate. But where are people with disabilities in this global movement? A few weeks ago, NACDD was invited to participate in a discussion with congressional staff, staff from the National Council on Disabilities, and several other disability advocates about a proposed legislation to address the environmental hazards of plastic. And while staff were clearly intent on doing the right thing to protect the environment, and we were so pleased to be asked to be experts in this issue, advocates in the room were struck by the lack of consideration or understanding of what people with disabilities really need when it comes to protecting our environment and making sure that this is not done at the expense of vulnerable populations. Threats to our environment disproportionately affect people with disabilities. So here to talk a little bit more yet the needs of people with disabilities are often an afterthought when policymakers attempt to address these issues. NACDD, and I think all of us, think that we need a disability-inclusive approach when taking action to address threats to our environment and climate change. That's why I'm so pleased to introduce our speakers today, who will talk about why people with disabilities need to be involved in finding real solutions to environmental threats. First, Cheryl Grossman, who has spent 20 years in the disability rights field. In the last 10 years, she specialized in the area of advocacy with multiple minority group members and those with rare conditions. As part of her work, Cheryl advises members of Congress and their staff about the dangers of plastic bans and the importance of inclusion with people with disabilities in the development of environmental policies. Cheryl has a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's degree in social work, both from the University of Washington in St. Louis. Our other speaker, Kelly Israel, is a policy analyst at the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, ASAN, here at the National Office. Kelly is a graduate of the American University Washington College of Law and served as a student attorney in its Disability Rights Law Clinic. And in that capacity, she was legal counsel for clients with disabilities in a wide variety of cases, including special education and the ADA reasonable accommodations. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Cheryl for her remarks. Cheryl, take it away.
Thank you so much, Erin. My name is Cheryl Grossman. For those who do not know me, I'm the community living advocate at the National Council on Independent Living, which is the longest-running national cross-disability grassroots organization that's run by and for people with disabilities. It was founded in 1982. And NICL represents thousands of organizations and individuals who advocate for the human and civil rights of people with disabilities throughout the United States. And I'll just note that my title as community living advocate puts me squarely in the center of home and community-based services and full inclusion and participation in community, which is where I intersect with the environmental issues that we're going to talk about a little bit today. I realize we're a little bit over time, so I'm going to jump around a little bit on my prepared remarks, and if we have time, I'll come back to the larger issue of disaster preparedness. Climate change has long been something that we've been concerned about, not just because we want to be good stewards of the earth that we live on, like those around us, but also because we tend to be the quoted canary in the coal mine. People with disabilities tend to be harder and more frequently affected by even small changes in the environment, in effect shouldering the greatest burden from its impact. Climate risks disproportionately harm those of us who are already vulnerable because of racial and socioeconomic disparities, lack of access to transportation, lack of disability access and emergency shelter, lack of access to home and community-based services and supports in times of disaster and recovery all further limit people with disabilities' ability to escape danger, and having escaped that danger limits our ability to return back home. In recent years, the solution when faced with homelessness as a result of a disaster is to send us into institutions rather than working to secure accessible transportation, temporary shelter, home and community-based services, technology and equipment, and assistance with rebuilding. More information about that and forced institutionalization of disabled people during and after disasters can be found in the NCD report that Erin sent out before this call. You can always also reach myself or someone else here at NICL. Disabled people need to be at the table to design and implement the solutions that allow us to remain in the community through and after disasters that are so often being fueled by climate change. One of the issues that folks have been interested about and that got onto the agenda for today are the issue of single-use plastics. The above things that I mentioned have some fairly obvious intersections between environmental issues and disability issues. But I want to sort of focus in on some of the lesser known things. In 2008, the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act, or the ADAAA, was passed. This clarified that certain bodily functions like GI functioning, breathing, and immune functioning could be considered as quoted major life activities when determining eligibility under the definition of disability. This meant that millions more Americans, often with non-standard or less visible disabilities, were in fact being protected. And as such, many more of us ventured out into the community than we ever had before. Here again, we ended up being the canary in the coal mine. Many of us experience difficulty breathing when we come into contact with smoke, perfumes, chemical cleaning solutions, paints, glues, and so many other toxins, often made from petrochemicals, an ingredient in most plastics as well. Exposures to these toxins that may be harmful over time for the average human can land us in the hospital or worse. Another example of this is the use of single-use plastic shopping bags. Many municipalities are putting taxes on the use of these bags as they're not sustainable for the environment. This is often happening when disabled people have not been at the table trying to help devise solutions. What decision makers and much of the public are missing when the suggestion is made using reusable cloth or string bags as opposed to single-use plastic bags, is that this puts the very lives of many of these disabled people on the line, including my own. For those of us who have compromised immune systems, reusing a bag that has not been sterilized properly after holding raw produce or meat can spread bacteria that can sicken the average person, but can actually kill many of us with much more easily affected immune systems. The supposed solution of allowing disabled people to use single-use plastic bags is also not a viable answer because it singles us out as destroyers of the planet while at the same time ostracizing us, taking us back 30 years of progress in terms of isolating us where we are. What do I mean by that? The beauty of the laws that protect us is that we use them to live, to work, and to play in the community. This often involves eating. For those of us with low immune systems, we no longer can venture out and eat at a friend's place for fear that ingredients in this meal were stored with bacteria from last week's meat run. We're now forced back into the back rooms of our homes and isolated like we were in the 1970s, or we risk our lives. Once again, not being at that table with the environmentalists, the manufacturers, the regulators, when products are being invented, discussed, researched, used, and banned, our lives, as well as our voices, may be lost. Speaking of these bans and the losses, there's been much discussion lately of plastic straws and bans. So why should disabled people and our supporters care about the issue? Because we will and have already lost our lives when plastic straws are banned. To those who believe that straws of other materials can work, it's not currently a reality. Paper and plant-based straws fall apart or can't hold the weight of someone leaning on the straw in order to drink. Certain plant-based straws have caused serious allergy issues and seizure issues for people with certain disabilities, as well as those who use certain medications. Metal straws conduct heat and cold and can cause serious injuries. They can also be very difficult to sterilize. To those who think that the answer lost my place. To those who think that the answer is that individuals should carry our own straws with us, this is not really a reality also due to straws getting crushed, torn, or simply not being able to be kept sterile. We add on to this the concept of the ban for straws, plastic straws. What happens when a product is banned is that less of it gets produced, meaning that even in the case where there's an exception to allow a disabled person to request a straw, it eventually will not be available when it's needed. Let me give you a couple of examples of things that I personally have heard over the last several months. The first is a case of a new mom who's breastfeeding, who's also straw dependent to drink and works in the community. The straw ban went into effect, and as such, she wasn't drinking during the day while in the community for work. As a result, her milk dried up, and then she needed to buy expensive formula for the baby. This all on a fixed income. After a few months, she wasn't able to keep up with the rent because of the added cost of formula. Eventually, she and all four of her children ended up being evicted and homeless, at which point a social worker stepped in and said this is not a safe environment for the children and took the kids. A second example is a case where a gentleman who is straw dependent was not able to get a straw while out on a hot day for several hours while waiting for paratransit. Dehydration coupled with medication usage contributed to a UTI, which caused sepsis and in turn caused death. A third case is one on a more mega scale, where a municipality put a straw ban in effect at the same time as a ban on single-use plastic water bottles. While they meant to put in place water refilling stations, these didn't end up being ready at the time that the bans went into effect, which left people unable to refill refillable bottles. These stations, also because they did not include disabled people in their planning and development, also ended up being too far apart from each other for people getting around on mobility devices. So they'd be left in the middle with nowhere and no ability to get water. So turning us back to the straw ban, when there are fewer straws available, the cost of these straws, the ones that are still available, go up. When a straw costs more, a retailer will either pass that along to a user, which makes this a disability tax, not okay. Same thing happens with the plastic bag taxes. Or they pass this along to everyone, which then furthers the stereotype of, oh, the bad disabled people who are killing our sea turtles. We don't believe that this issue should ever devolve into a competition between saving disabled people or saving sea turtles. Both are important. We have one Earth. We all need to live here. If we're all at the same table and we're helping to solve the problem other than putting disabled people at risk, we feel like, you know, there's a lot of room to go forward without pitting one entity against another. But if we don't move quickly to get in on the ground level of these discussions regarding environmental policy, I fear we'll lose much of the gains that we've made over the last 30 years of living and working and playing in the community and our progress towards inclusion. And this shouldn't all be because of plastic straws. And let me ask folks, do I have another couple minutes just to go into the mega emergency preparedness things, or should I turn that over?
Let's go to Kelly, and then if we have time, we can talk about the bills that we have.
Okay.
All right, Kelly, do you want to jump in? Kelly, are you on the line?
Yeah, I am. I'm sorry. Sorry, I forgot to turn myself off mute. Unfortunately, Unfortunately, Cheryl Grossman has covered like half of what I intended to present, but I will present the remainder with feeling. Okay, so my name is Kelly Israel. I work as a policy analyst at ASAN, which is shorthand for saying that anything that has to do with legal and public policy, I am generally involved in it. Doesn't matter what it is, I'm generally present. I'm not like the grassroots feet on the ground. So to a certain extent, I can't describe the impact of a piece of legislation based on what actually happens. Cheryl has that knowledge. But I can describe what's likely to happen based on the text and the language I've seen and what I would recommend instead. So we of the disability rights community, as Cheryl Grossman has helpfully pointed out, are actually more affected by environmental disasters than other people. It's not like we have no reason to care about the impact of human activity on the environment. In fact, we have reason to care all the more. However, the problem is that so many of the solutions that are proposed don't even appear to have considered the broader implication of people with disabilities being a large community of people with diverse needs. For instance, the sheer number of municipalities which have passed plastic bag bans. They've been doing it for a long time. There aren't too many statewide bans of single-use plastics, but there are a whole lot of citywide laws. Most of these municipal laws are plastic bag bans, which cause exactly the problem Cheryl identified for people with more compromised immune systems. A couple of municipalities also ban specifically plastic straws, like Washington, D.C., and parts of the state of Washington. Now, like I said, I don't exactly have my feet on the ground, but any sort of wholesale single-use plastic ban for a particular type of plastic is likely to cause some pretty significant problems for people with disabilities in that area in terms of accessing the community and accessing services. Because at the end of the day, it's not just about living, it's about accessing a particular place in the community. Like, for instance, if there is a plastic straw ban in Washington, D.C., and I can't drink except out of plastic straws, if I go to a Starbucks in that Washington, D.C., even if there is a provision that allows me to ask for a single-use plastic straw as a reasonable accommodation, I'm still having to out myself as a person with a disability in front of an essentially massive crowd of people. I'm also basically betting whether I can go to a store or not based on how many single-use plastic straws they have left, because they're not going to have as many since they're not buying for the general public anymore. And like common sense, matter of practicality, sooner or later, a person with a disability is going to go into a business, ask for a plastic straw, and even though they're supposed to provide them upon request, the store or business isn't actually going to have the object, simply because they've run out. And at that exact moment, that store has just violated the Americans with Disabilities Act by refusing to offer services of the same quality or type to people without disabilities. In fact, outright accidentally refusing them services. These kinds of cases are going to come up a lot more often, although it's unclear whether they will actually be enforced or prosecuted. So, on the federal level, we actually have, there has actually been a bill that was proposed. Remember that meeting that Aaron Prangley mentioned that NACCD went to about proposition of a single-use plastic ban? Well, that actually deals with a specific bill, which is called the Udall Lowenthal Bill. Now, the main problem that I have with the Udall Lowenthal Bill is that it appears to have been made without really any consideration of any of these factors. The bill straight up bans grocery stores, restaurants, beverage providers, vendors, or other retail or service establishments from selling plastic beverage straws, plastic stirrers, plastic plates, or plastic cutlery. And the only reference to disability in the ban is that to provide accessibility options to disability, they must provide it to the person with a disability on the request of the person. And that's going to create the problems I mentioned earlier. Now, some people might say something like, well, isn't that just like asking for reasonable accommodation? Well, not really. There's a qualitative difference between lining up at a crowded Starbucks and requesting that a cart be present at a conference. The latter person, the person requesting the cart, doesn't even have to identify themselves to the other participants. They only need to identify themselves to the host or the venue in advance, and none of the participants will even be aware of which person requested the cart. They'll just know that somebody did. The same sort of thing happens in school environments, too. Think of a situation in which the classroom does not have a ban on the use of laptops, and a person with ADD or autism needs a laptop in order to engage with the class. That person doesn't have to identify themselves either. They just have to bring their laptop, and any number of people with and without disabilities could have them. there are sort of generalized accommodations that don't even need to be made that people with disabilities make for themselves. And things that fall into this category are the use of single-use plastics and other such commodities. Like, they're just little things in the environment that everyone takes for granted and that people with disabilities have begun to take for granted that help accommodate them. There's no need for all of the fuss of identifying yourself as a person with a disability, of being subject to the stigma of other people. You just need to take it. With a wholesale ban on plastic straws, for example, that proposition would be taken off the table. People would have to identify themselves, and they'd have to do it in public, very, very publicly, and submit themselves to social anxiety. Like, think of a person with a developmental disability. Most of us have social anxiety. I literally haven't met one of us that doesn't have a co-occurring mental illness of some kind or mental health condition. Like, an autistic person will have to go up to the front store counter and straight up ask them for the straw, and some of them are just not going to be able to do it. They'll just leave the store. A lot of different issues exist, and there wasn't really any effort on the part of the legislators who proposed the Udall Lowenthal bill to reach out to people with disabilities for solutions, to ask us about what we think would actually work to protect the environment. There's actually good stuff in the bill. Like, there's stuff about manufacturing companies of these products taking responsibility for their disposal. That's great. That's good. That's exactly the kind of thing we need to see. But the ban is just snuck in there, and there's only like a half-hearted attempt to consider the needs of people with disabilities as a large population of people, subject to supply and demand, to constraints on their income, to social expectations of disability. So I guess the third problem I notice is that even with many cities making plastic bans, it doesn't really solve the problem of the pollution of our environment anyway. A large majority of the plastic that ends up in the oceans, despite horrifying viral turtle images, is actually used by businesses and manufacturing. So the nonprofit called the Ocean Cleanup has actually produced a comprehensive assessment of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is this enormous pile of trash that's in the oceans right now. They deployed 30 ships equipped to collect a wider range of debris sizes than before and repurposed military aircraft. After collecting and counting more than 1 million pieces of trash, what they found out is that the primary culprits were actually plastic used in fishing nets. Like, 46% of the entire mass was fishing nets. When combined with ropes and lines, it amounted to over half. The truth is, plastic doesn't just come from consumer plastic. It comes from multiple sources, and it contaminates the environment based on multiple sources, and a good chunk of it is commercial. By putting forth plastic bans, we're not going to solve the problem of environmental pollution. We're not even going to reduce it by all that much. Especially since a good majority of the pollution involved comes from countries with laxer requirements, to be honest. So without disability involved in the development of bills like this, this is the kind of thing we see. We see half-hearted considerations, small bones thrown out to people with disabilities, and while sort of a refusal to engage with the problem on a larger scale. We need to be, like, proactively involved in the development of federal, state, and local legislation. We need to proactively state that the needs of real, live human beings, no offense, Cheryl, matter more than the lives of sea turtles. We care about the environment, but we can't throw people under the bus for the sake of the environment. We need to do both. It can't be an either-or proposition. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kelly. And again, you know, I hope you all realize that I so enjoy working with you, Kelly, and you, Cheryl, as we continue to look at this legislation that hasn't been introduced yet, and hopefully we can make some improvements to that. I totally agree that there's a big component to this, with a component that it dismisses the bigger picture of the canary in the coal mine of and how this legislation must target the needs of people with disabilities and do so in a more comprehensive way that includes things like incentives for putting people with disabilities on the R&D boards, making sure that the research is directed towards solutions that work for people with disabilities. And there's so much more we'll need to do together. We only have about 3 minutes left, so I did want to open up for questions just really quickly. Are there any questions from the people on the phone?
Hi, and Brian, I have a question. It's awesome and amazing. I'm meeting with a local hospital about their neurology. Where am I going? Brendan and Mason about it.
So I'm sorry, I wasn't able to understand that. I think I got, are you looking for where are they with the straw ban and the federal legislation? That legislation has not been introduced yet. The good news is that the office is working on it. Did contact Kelly and Cheryl and myself at NACDD and a couple of other folks and have asked for our input. So that's why we wanted to talk to you today about this, as they're still working on drafting that legislation, but it should be introduced early next year. Is there any, was there something else in your question?
Yeah.
Brett was asking about where he could get some written information. He's talking to a local hospital in the very near future.
About their straw policy. Mainly, I had to ask for one 4 times.
Cheryl or Kelly, do you guys have anything written that we could send?
There are a whole lot of articles online on the subject of why straw bans can be seriously concerning with people with a variety of physical disabilities. I don't know about direct written information from my organization, but there are a whole lot of Washington Post articles. Like, just looking up straw ban and disability, and you'll find a ton.
This is Cheryl. I'll jump in also. If you can contact me after this call, I'll connect you with the local Center for Independent Living, and you can work with them specifically around that hospital and that hospital's issues, because your local still... that's really what they do, is they work with local folk to help overcome barriers like that.
That's great advice. And Cheryl, we're at the 3 o'clock mark, but did you want to mention some legislation people should be on the lookout for concerning in natural disasters or people in disasters?
Sure, this is Cheryl again. In the document that Erin sent around, from me, there's a little anecdote called The Curly Tale of the Three Little Pigs, or How FEMA Didn't Save Our Bacon. And this sort of, it's a funny anecdote that goes through the very real issues that individuals face during and after disasters. And it really mimicking the three little pigs and their houses blowing down and what happens as a result. And towards the end of the vignette, pig number 3 is talking, and there are 2 bills that are actually mentioned in that section. One of them, excuse me, is the Real Emergency Access for Aging and Disability Inclusion, known as the READY for Disasters Act, and also Casey has a bill, the Disaster Relief Medicaid Act, or DRMA. Those 2 bills address sort of the disparities that are being felt by disabled people during and after disasters, including if you end up homeless and need to go out of state and you happen to use a personal care assistant or a DSP worker and or have need of medical equipment, a wheelchair that may or may not be able to go with you or may have been damaged in floodwater, things like that, that may be portable with the DRMA and other things. So if folks are interested, please feel free to contact myself, and I can get you information about both bills and other initiatives that the disability community at large, along with our coalition partners, are really pushing for to ensure that disabled folk are not left behind in disasters, because we shouldn't be the ones who can't get out of danger or are losing out and aren't able to rebuild because we're forced into institutions and don't have the money to rebuild then afterwards.
I think that's going to have to be the final word, as we're a little bit over today. I want to thank so much Cheryl Grossman and Kelly Israel for your expertise, and thank you all for being on the phone today. And this concludes our NACDD quarterly policy call. I'm looking forward to talking to all of you again next year. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.